This is Radio EcoShock. We are covering the West Coast appearance of the Transition Movement. Joanne Poirot co-founded a community group that became Transition Los Angeles. She continues as part of that core team while participating in her local Westchester neighborhood of L.A. Joanne, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Los Angeles is so huge, 10 million people, it seems impossible to imagine anything sustainable developing there. Can you give us some concrete examples of what is happening in these early days of transition in L.A.?
Well, at the current moment, we have from 6 to 9 local groups happening. They're all working along the lines of the transition movement internationally, and they put on quite a panorama of events, everything from alternative health fairs to building community gardens to looking at water issues to creating time banks, a wide variety of awareness-raising movies and events, a lot of the things that you see in other transition projects around the world.
And as I understand it, according to the website, there's a ladder of self-organizing units that you have been calling pods, although that may be in transition too. What are pods and how is that developing?
Pods was one of our early names for what would we call these local subgroups within Los Angeles. Realize that LA is a vast basin geographically with just wall-to-wall people here, and we were trying to figure out how to use the localization model that had come out of small towns in England and adapt it to this massive geography. And at first we were talking about pods being the local groups within Los Angeles, but at this point we tend to use just the terminology of local groups. And at the current moment, they're in all kinds of stages of formation, from very active and groups that have events multiple times a month to some that just meet once a month and are a small circle of people.
Some of the things that I'm seeing there remind me of what's happening here in Vancouver. We find people create new community, sometimes based on neighborhoods and who's right around you, but also through common interests. For example, we have gays and lesbians organizing for sustainability. What sort of interest groups have you seen?
Well, one of the things that we early on realized was that people in LA are very accustomed to driving to get to things, and that if we were to go to a pure localization model, that it didn't necessarily work for the way people think or identify. So we started really with models of belonging, like where did people feel they fit in? Where did they feel a sense of community already? So some of our early centers were a yoga center, a community garden, an Episcopal church, places that people already felt a sense of connection where they would return to find that sense of a circle of like-minded people with whom to explore these ideas.
And then the local groups communicate through the Transition Los Angeles Hub. Can you describe how the hub works?
Well, the hub's very simple. It's really a opportunity for the leaders to get together and to discuss leadership issues. When you're leading a transition group or any community group, you come up against those knotty issues of, you know, how do you deal with this conflict or this schedule issue, or is this a good route, or we're having difficulties with, you know, the following items, and you need someone to bounce those ideas off of. And it's really helpful to have fellow leaders who are working, you know, alongside you and really can understand that and say, hey, we've been there, we did that, and this is what we tried.
And how does all that relate to Transition US?
We communicate with Transition US. We're also, when people connect with Transition US and are looking for people in Los Angeles, they find us through the network. At the same time, we do a lot of outreach and answering questions like this interview, like interviews we do, to help other areas understand about the transition movement, the basic premises of it, how people are approaching things. So we're always available to help people get started.
You mentioned community gardens, and it's a great place to grow things, but I do remember just a few years ago on YouTube watching the video of protests of a large community garden that was taken down. I don't know whether it was the city or a private developer. Have a lot more new community gardens sprung up, and how can we handle this problem of ownership of the land itself?
Well, in my own neighborhood, we're building a new community garden this year, and certainly I think that the awareness in the last 3 to 5 years has highlighted the need for increased numbers of places for people to grow food. So that certainly helps as far as getting through the red tape and making these community gardens come into existence.
Is there any support or understanding from City Hall?
Certainly. We're working with the mayor's office right now. We're working with LAUSD. That's the massive school district here.
I lived in L.A. in the Silver Lake area quite a few years back, and I've returned several times in recent years. One obvious change is a different kind of transition, the change to Spanish speakers in many neighborhoods. Is there a Latino transition movement?
Not yet, but there's always time. We've really only been in existence as Transition Los Angeles for a bare 2 years. And in that time, we've grown from just a single group that had an idea and a connection to this international movement to going on 9 active local groups offering events and gatherings every single month. So any day now, we will hear from people who can speak Spanish. I can't speak Spanish myself, otherwise I'd be out there starting it.
Hablo poco. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Our guest is Joanne Poirot, one of the organizers of Transition Los Angeles. Joanne, one problem I did have looking at the website, it describes peak oil and climate change as motivators, but it didn't seem to talk about the economic crash, and that seems odd, considering the big hole that used to be California real estate, all the foreclosures, the unemployment, you know the scene. Why not use that to promote self-sufficiency and sustainability in hard times?
Well, actually, that is highlighted on our Transition Los Angeles level website. I think that part of that in the national organization is somewhat of a question of whether they're seeing it coming out of England or not, where this movement started. I'm working myself on a paper right now about the economics and transition movement, so it certainly is very much a part of what's going on here in Los Angeles. Southern California experienced some of the worst of that real estate crash, so it's definitely present in our local populace. And you know, as with anything transition, things are very localized. It's really going to be driven by the issues that people in the local geography are experiencing and grappling with.
So you see West Coast Americans understanding the transition movement differently than the original organizers in Britain?
I see every single local organization understanding it ever so slightly differently because they have different sets of circumstances that they're dealing with. For instance, when the materials came out of England, we laughed at them here in LA because they never mentioned water. Here in Los Angeles, that's a huge issue as far as sustainability, and obviously it's not a problem in England.
What do you think the biggest problems are we still have to solve to make the transition movement go mainstream?
I think one of the biggest problems is courage, that people are beginning to realize at this time that things aren't as they thought they were, particularly with regards to the economic situation. And although people see that things are changed or changing, it takes a tremendous amount of courage to put your money where your mouth is, to actually make those huge transformative adjustments in your everyday lifestyle, and perhaps even in the lifestyles of your children and your expectations for the future. That takes a lot of courage and confidence in your ideas. And as we grow greater numbers of people who are willing to do that, I think that this whole wave of change, Joanna Macy calls it the Great Turning. I think that a lot of that will change a whole lot faster the more people start to come on board because people feel that they have company in that journey.
Well, and two, another problem I think is that the mainstream media are telling us that things are fine. We're in the recovery. It's all going well. And as long as people can believe in that daydream, they're going to keep hanging on, commuting 1,000 miles to work and going shopping at the big chain stores. So in a way, we sort of need a couple more shocks, I think, to wake people up.
I'm enjoying a billboard that is near my home, and I pass it several times a week, and it says, "The recession is over? Would somebody tell my portfolio?" And I think that that really reflects a lot of people's feeling is, although we've got the media saying this, people aren't feeling it. There's a lot of people around me who are still unemployed. There's a lot of people around me who are now underemployed than they were before this whole thing started. And a lot of the materials that I read indicate that this is only the first of it. We have a whole lot more to come. And given that, it really demands that we be thinking in new and different ways. And the transition movements concepts of self-sufficiency and local resilience feed right into the same answers that we come up with as far as how to cope with an economic issue.
Do you have new projects you want to tell us about?
I think that a lot of our projects here in Los Angeles thus far have been getting new local groups started. That's been a huge emphasis over the last 2 years. But as we start to have more established groups, we're starting to see specialization in those groups where, for instance, in Transition Mar Vista, we have a lot of people interested in alternative health. They now have a community wellness forum once every 2 weeks that brings together local practitioners. We have time banks sprouting up in Whittier and San Fernando Valley, new efforts to create those kind of concepts in alternative economics. We have, I previously mentioned, the new garden in Westchester, but there are many local gardens and a whole change in consciousness about local food and seeing how much can be grown here in Los Angeles. We have a year-round growing season, and so there's really no reason we shouldn't be growing food instead of grass.
Do you have a couple of web links you'd like to give for our listeners?
Well, anyone wants to find out about Transition Los Angeles, we're at transitionla.org, and you can find just about everything on there about us.
We could spend an hour on this, and I'd like to sometime, but that's our brief report from Los Angeles for this week. My thanks to you, Joanne Poirot, for sharing your time and energy.
Thanks for having me on your show.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. How can the great city of Vancouver regroup into intimate and sustainable neighborhoods? Let's find out what is going on in this greening city on the west coast of Canada. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. In January 2011, I recorded two introductory speakers at a meetup for Village Vancouver. Early founders Ann Pacey and Ross Moster address a group of 35 people around the big table with plates of homemade potluck food on the go.
Hi, I'm Ann. I'm a member of the core group and also one of the conveners, co-conveners for the Dunbar Village. I've been involved with Village Vancouver for about 2 years, and that kind of grew out of the fact that 2004 I started studying climate change, and then I started studying peak oil, and I kind of scared myself to death. And so when I moved to, I heard about Transition really right after it got started in 2007, but I was living in Peru. So there really wasn't much activity going on. So when I came to Vancouver, I searched out Ross and have gotten involved. And for me, it's really, you know, the only, it's a substantial way of moving forward to address the issues that we all face together.
And I'm Ross, and I'm the convener for Village Vancouver. So been involved since the beginning. And my interest, since I kind of am the person that is always bugging people to get involved and do stuff, my interests are like the whole ball of wax, basically. But my particular interest is around food. I'm a member of the Vancouver Food Policy Council, and then also around other stuff. I'm on the Carfree board, but really just kind of everything. So.
Yeah, we put together this presentation as kind of a general introduction to what Village Vancouver is for an audience that may not necessarily be exposed to it. And before I get started, just how many of you guys have heard about peak oil before? And how many of you kind of consider that you have a fairly deep understanding of what the consequences of peak oil are? Okay, great. Because I really have a tendency to go over the top. I mean, I've been spending the last 6 years, I probably put in 8-10 hours a week reading about this stuff. So, I mean, my husband kind of looks at me like, oh, there you are again. You're the doomer and the gloomer. We're not going to go there tonight. But I think it is important that we, as Rob said, I mean, transition was really evolved around the whole question of this transition that we've got to make in how we energize our societies, both from the point of view that we are, in fact, running out of easily accessible, cheap oil, which is what our societies were built upon, and the other side of it is that the waste that's produced by burning that energy has created these horrendous consequences, which is climate change, which we're actually facing, too. So the question is, you know, which one gets us first, you know? Climate change or peak oil? Yeah, that's basically what we want to just briefly cover. What is peak oil? What is climate change? And what is Village Vancouver doing in the context of that? What are we doing here locally? And then what can I do as an individual? Village Vancouver was officially granted transition status in December of last year. So we have been an official part of the transition network since 2009. We were set up to meet those two basic challenges of climate change and peak oil. And what that means in terms of transition, it means going from a city where we're tremendously dependent upon energy, fossil fuel energy, to one that is much more resilient to interruptions in that supply. So we find other ways to fuel ourselves. So the three issues then, just very briefly, climate change, and I'm not using global warming because where you are depends very much on how it actually is. And there are a number of people who actually might think we're flipping into a climate freeze. I mean, we're actually due for an ice age as opposed to heating up. But who knows how it's going to end up? Our models really don't tell us that much. But what we do know is we know we're going from a very stable period of time to an unstable period of time. And that's, I mean, scientists tend to be really kind of, you know, 99%, 95%. But I mean, frankly, we all pretty much know that this is caused by anthropogenic forcing. And the second point is peak oil. And peak oil, a lot of people are confused about this, and I know I'm preaching to or talking to people who already know about this. It's not when we run out. It's actually when we can't produce more. And Rob made that video in 2009. Actually, this year, the International Energy Agency has just admitted that we hit a peak in conventional oil back in 2006. So the international agency responsible for advising international governments or governments around the world has admitted to the fact that we know we have peaked in our conventional oil, and it's been 4 years now, almost 5 years now. So the stuff that's making up that difference in our growth is not conventional. It's the more expensive, the much more expensive stuff, the much lower density energy. Yeah, ethanol, shale, I mean, yeah. natural gas, liquids from natural gas, all of that stuff is making up the difference. But the cheap, easy-to-pump stuff is basically hit a peak, and they're now projecting it's going to be declining at 9% a year. So we're right there. We're right where we're really going to start to see these effects happening. 2008 was just a preview of it, and a lot of people think 2011, 2012 is going to get pretty nasty out there. Those are both occurring in the overall context, and I know somebody mentioned it about our overconsumption, in the fact that we have exceeded the planet's capacity to provide for us, both in terms of resources as well as terms of waste sinks. So we've pushed the planet to its limits. So peak oil and gas, I mean, this is one of the classic curves. It just kind of shows, I mean, this is, you know, right around where we are right now, and you know, things are starting to decline. We've probably peaked already overall globally in terms of all energy sources, certainly in terms of conventional. But meanwhile, the demand for energy is increasing, and particularly with regard to China and India, which creates an interesting geopolitical context, shifting context. And there's just no way we've got other sources of energy to fill that gap. So we're really hitting a limit. Our energy that provides our society with the ability to be as complex as it is not sufficient or to maintain that complexity. So we're going to start seeing a de-complexing, simplifying of our economy. I talk with my hands. I lived in Latin America for too long. Yeah, so what are the consequences of peak oil? And I think this is something that people really don't get an idea. They don't really have a very clear idea of how fundamental oil is to every aspect of our society and what happens when oil starts to go up. I mean, we saw the effects to a certain extent in 2008, although most of the media were laying the blame on speculation. The peak oil group in general thinks it was an initial effect of that peaking, where it's a plateau, dropping down, economic recession, demand drops, so the price drops. So those kinds of fluctuations we're going to be seeing. It's not just a steady uphill climb. But that increase in price of oil really feeds into across the board. It goes into food. Food right now is at an all-time high. Many of the food commodities are back above the 2008 levels. Again, peak oil people think it has a very direct impact on economic growth, and the mainstream economists tend to put that down. They don't think it's so clearly important, but it does, in fact, affect the dynamics, cost of everything that we're doing. Everything that is produced by oil becomes expensive and scarce. And that includes all the food. I mean, one of the things, I mean, if we talk a lot about food here, right now our food is produced by petroleum, and I think a lot of you already know that. I mean, anywhere from 7 to 10 calories of oil energy is required to produce 1 calorie of food that we consume. That's from the tilling of the land, to the planting, to the fertilizers, to the pesticides, to the harvesting, to the transport, to the processing facilities, to the processing, to the packaging, to the distribution, to then getting into the consumer's home. All of that requires a huge amount of oil as an input. So our agricultural system is very vulnerable right now to oil prices. It's vulnerable in a number of other monoculture. I mean, you can think of a lot of other ways it's as vulnerable, but oil is definitely one of the key factors that's going to have a tremendous impact on our ability to feed ourselves. I mean, I think everybody also is aware of the fact that we've got about 3 days of supply of food in our supermarkets. I mean, they do just-in-time delivery, so we basically have no ability to weather more than just about 3 days, 5 days of shutdown. If there's any reason at all we can't truck food in, what's going to happen here? I mean, that's the kind of thinking that somebody should be going through. I mean, we don't have the ability to maintain our population right now. Our food shed for Vancouver doesn't come close to feeding us. And globalization. Globalization was built on sheep transport. So as oil goes up, globalization starts to unravel. So it's actually a really tremendously important issue that we should all understand. And I don't think I'm going to say anything more about it, because I think I've gotten gloomy and doomy enough.
You're listening to part of a meetup of Village Vancouver, starting with Ann Pacey. This is Radio EcoShock. Next up, Ross Mostert.
Yeah, I'll try and cheer everybody up. So Village Vancouver, we started about almost 3 years ago, and we weren't initially part of the transition movement. We hadn't actually heard of it, but then we started noticing as we went along that what we were doing was the same thing as transition towns, so we decided to hook up and make it official. There's about 18 different official transition towns in Canada. I think we're the 9th or 10th, although in terms of age, if we had applied originally, we would have been the 1st or 2nd. I'm kind of known for giving different descriptions of Village Vancouver every time, but I keep trying to simplify it, and I think the one that I like the best, and there's a couple of variations, and what it is, I like to say Village Vancouver is like real life, only more sustainable. Or Village Vancouver is like real life, only more resilient. And what that means is anything is within our purview, because really what we're trying to do is create the capacity to shift the paradigm from this totally unsustainable society where we're rapidly going down the tubes to one where we're resilient. And resilient, of course, is the ability of something to absorb shocks and bounce back and keep going. So it's really a simple concept what we're trying to do. As we went around the room, you know, we kind of learned, and I knew this was going to happen, there's like a fantastic amount of resources. And I didn't live in Latin America, but I use my hands anyway. We just have a fantastic amount of resources right within our communities, within our neighborhoods, on our blocks. But we tend not to know our neighbors, so we don't utilize those resources. And it's a tremendous waste. And we're sitting there, we're kind of looking out for government to solve our problems. or for experts, and we're always looking the distance. But we really have a lot of the answers to create this really, even in the face of all these problems, to create this really abundant type of existence that's celebratory, that's fun, that meets our needs. But it just happens to be an existence that uses a lot less energy because we're going to be doing things differently. So that's what Village Vancouver is about. It's about connecting people in community, taking advantage by working collaboratively of using those resources. So when, for instance, we're starting Seed Collective, so Alexis put up a thing on the Seed Savers page, anybody interested in Strathcona and starting a Seed Collective, and a bunch of people responded. And that's really how simple it is. It's getting together, being a little intentional about creating this, meeting other people with similar interests, because another part of Village Vancouver, it's not like, oh, you should be doing this or you should be doing that. It's like, what are you interested in? So if you like to repair bicycles, we're not going to send you a note saying, you're supposed to be gardening, what's wrong with you? You know, we're going to say, okay, let's hook you up with other people that like to repair bicycles. If you want to garden, we want to, you know, hook you up with those people. So that's the whole idea. We have no budget, okay? So we put on like 100 workshops a year. People give us space, you know, we pay the presenters and maybe they give us a donation or something. But we do all this without money because we believe that it's not important. I mean, it's not that we're adverse to money, but it's like we don't want to wait for a grant to come to go out and do something, because what happens if it doesn't come? Do we stop? You know, it's like we're our own best resources, so we just go out and do it. And that's the whole idea. And it's totally people power driven. So What we like to do is we like to encourage you to just get involved in the basis of your interest. And we do that through our neighborhood villages. We have a number of villages. You'll hear about one of them tonight. We have projects, we have working groups, we have networks, and that's kind of basically what it is. Very, very simple idea. It's kind of rediscovering, like the name of the film that we're going to show you a segment from, is rediscovering the power of community. So, well, a lot of what we do, we found the website, which has only been up for a year, and we've got like we're getting close to 1,000 members now. You can join a village there. You can join one of the networks, and then you meet other people. The website's just a portal. I mean, if you just stay on the website and don't do anything else, then it's, you know, la-di-da. But the idea is like you go, okay, I'm in Strathcona, so who else is in Strathcona Village? Oh, they're in there, and they're having a seed-saving meeting, or they're having a potluck. I think I'll go to that. And I'll talk to people and find out who's interested in gardening or who's interested in this and that. And that's kind of where it all starts. And we've had pretty amazing results from there because, you know, you start meeting people and you start figuring out, you know, finding out what they're interested in. And
I think educating yourself, too, on an ongoing basis. And there's an amazing amount of information out on the web. And there's really positive stuff. And there's some that, you know, you just kind of want to slash your wrists afterwards. And I stay away from that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, so we freak out because these are pretty bad. I mean, these are horrible problems we're facing. But the question is, what do we do in response to them? Do we slit our wrists or do we make a positive response and do something about it? And that's
and doing it in community. And I think that's the key to the whole idea of the transition town.
There's a part of this that nobody knows. We're inventing as we go along because nobody's ever done this before. And there's a saying, we don't even know if this is going to work or not. You know, it's kind of like this big experiment. We have Village Vancouver, we have a steering committee, and then we have we have different working groups and networks within Village Vancouver. So those are kind of communities of interest. And within those groups, there might be projects. And then we also have neighborhood villages, which are geographic communities. And the idea is really, there's no hierarchy. It's like this flat thing. So villages, there are people in villages that contribute to the working groups and to the steering committee. People in the steering committee are part of villages. And so it's this kind of helping each other this way rather than something like this. And we'll see how it turns out. But so far, so good.
That was part of a Village Vancouver meetup. The room was filled with energy and people connecting. Use these ideas to start your own neighborhood transition group. Find out more at villagevancouver.ca. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.